The Fan on Demand. Cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Reviewing every game like Hawkeye Tennis Technology. This is Aces with Roger Lajoie and Tom Tebbett of Tennis Canada. Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
And this is indeed Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Good evening, everybody. I'm Roger Lajoie here in our Toronto studio. Tom Tebbett is live on location at the Rogers Cup in Montreal, where he'll be spending a couple of days, and he'll be back in Toronto for the Rogers Cup in Toronto. And we will talk Rogers Cup later in the show, because you have one more chance to win yourself a pair of tickets to the Rogers Cup coming up on Tuesday here. Some of the top women's players in the world coming into Toronto. You always have time to ask Tom a question, although you got to do it because we are live tonight. So your question is welcome. Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. Drop us an email. Your question for Tom. Some people have already dropped the questions. They're ahead of the time. So we'll read yours for sure, because you mailed them in even before show started. We'll do our draw later in the program. We have our mystery sounder. Hey, coming up, Jeannie Bouchard, Monica Seles. How about that? For two great guests picked up by our friend Mr. Tebbett in Montreal, and he joins us on the line now. Tom, exciting time with the Rogers Cup finally here, and I think we're set up for two pretty good events coming up.
Yeah, it looks like it. I hate to say the one thing everybody worried about today, and kind of expected maybe that Roger Federer might pull out, because we know his back's been bothering him and he was hesitating, but no word that I know of so far, and I think at that point, no news is good news, so we'll keep our fingers crossed that he'll make it. And I saw Nadal practicing today, and Andy Murray, he was in the players' lounge, and he was all upset because he practiced at about 10 o'clock this morning because one of his coaches, his friend Danny Valverde, said it was going to rain at 11:30. This was about 12:30, and there had been no rain. So he was giving him a hard time, but he was there at 5 o'clock last night, and he was there at 9 or 10 o'clock this morning, so I think Murray's got his game face on.
That's great, and fingers crossed that Federer does play as well. Always worried about withdrawals on the women's side. We're going to get to Jeannie Bouchard in a second, but let's talk about that. Disappointing when one of the top and most popular women's players doesn't come. But, Tom, you got to concentrate on the field that's there, and it's a pretty darn good one.
Well, it is. I mean, you've still got Serena and Azarenka and Radwanska, Kvitova, Wozniacki, Kirilenko, Stosur, Stevens, Ivanovic, Yankovic, lots of good players. And I think, I don't think there's been too much talk about this, but something fairly serious may be going on with Sharapova. We just don't know. She pulled out of Stanford a couple weeks ago. Now she's pulled out of this one. And there's a lot of mystery surrounding this. So she had the hip problem from the falls at Wimbledon. And I have a slight sense that it could be more serious than we think. So let's hope that it's nothing too bad.
Let's hope so for sure. Tom Tebbett, Roger Lajoie, it's Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Okay, Tom, quickly, set up Jeannie Bouchard. What a great story she is.
Well, she is. We know she won both the singles and the doubles last year at Wimbledon in the juniors, and that was, you know, a big step for her. She thinks she's been as high as 53 in the rankings. She's now 58, and she just has a lot of promise. She really has all the strokes, but she also has a tremendous competitive drive. So a very promising player, and obviously the people have their chances here in Toronto next week.
And a great chance to listen to her now. Here's Tom's conversation with Jeannie Bouchard.
Jeannie Bouchard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're getting to be quite a well-known player these days. You have to do a lot of interviews, and I assume sometimes you get the same question and it gets a little bit boring. What would you say is the most annoying question you get asked over and over?
Well, you know, I mean, it's great, obviously, to have people who care enough to ask you these questions, but for sure it can get a little repetitive. I'd say the one that's a bit, you know, annoying would just be, you know, how I started in tennis. I'd say I've said that story like 100 times, you know. I started at 5 years old, you know, did groups, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like, you know, people know now when I've started, so I don't know why I have to keep saying it, but, you know, I always say my story.
Right, well, I've been around tennis. It's different in every town, so they want to hear it over again, I guess. But
yeah,
this may be another one that you've been asked a little bit. You're a twin, and your sister is Beatrice. Yep. I've forgotten who's older.
She's 6 minutes older, but I am 3 inches taller.
Oh, is that it? Okay. I just always wondered, how much of an athlete is she? I know that your mental side is a strong part of your game. Does she have any of the physical ability you have? And I guess she just didn't have the same drive that you did to be a tennis player.
Yeah, well, it's funny because we're twins, but we're very different, you know, physically and mentally, you know, our personalities are completely opposite. And, you know, it's true. From a young age, I had, you know, more of the drive and the discipline. And, you know, she was more the social one, the social butterfly. And, you know, I mean, it's great. We're completely different. And we kind of complement each other. But she's definitely more of, you know, normal teenager, goes to school. She's social, has all her friends and everything. And I'm more, you know, the athletic-driven one. So it's interesting to see.
You were on the World Team Tennis Team in Texas with the Bryan twins. Did you guys talk at all about being twins? And
yeah.
Did you get any insights to twins?
Well, they're also identical twins. And it's funny because Bob was just saying, you know what? He's like, twins are freaks. He admits. He's like, we're all freaks. You know, what are we doing? he's like, Mike and I were supposed to be one person, and now we're two, you know?
Right.
So it's pretty funny. You know, but I mean, it's really cool for them that both of them turned out that way. You know, they're very, very similar. And in my case, we're very different. So, you know, it's interesting for both, but I'm glad that, you know, my sister is different. And so, you know, when we're home, it's not like, you know, it's not like we always do the same thing. You know, we can be different and, you know, talk about our own lives because our lives are very different.
The first time I thought you might be a very good player was when you won two futures events, 10,000 events in Sweden in May of 2012. Mm-hmm. I think you just turned 18 and you won them back-to-back in Bostad. The competition wasn't that great, but I'm sure that after you won the first week, everybody was gunning for you. And that was a pretty good result for you playing against, you know, other women from the tour. Was that really an important breakthrough for you?
Thank you. Yes, it was. You know, it was interesting that I decided to go do those because, you know, some people could say, well, you know, don't you feel above 10,000? But for me, you know, I had lost, I'd played in the U.S. some tougher challengers and I'd lost first round, you know, a few weeks in a row. And, you know, my mom thought, you know what, why not just go down a level and go win? You know, there's something to be said about not losing a match in a whole week. And so I went. It was horrible conditions. It was freezing, raining, everything, you know, really, really slow red clay. And, you know, I had pressure because I was one of the top seeds both weeks, and especially after winning the first, I had pressure the second week. So, you know, I went there. It was all mental, and I just worked on my game and worked on it, and I was able to win both. And I'm very proud of that because that was, you know, it doesn't look like much, but it was a very big accomplishment for me. And I think it started, you know, my good success afterwards. You know, I had, you know, after that I was in Europe, and then I won Roehampton, Wimbledon, and then, you know, started really, you know, playing well.
You went from 302 to 144 last year, and was there a tournament or a particular match that really gave you confidence to turn things around for you?
Well, obviously, I'd have to say winning Wimbledon juniors. You know, even though that was juniors, it gave me a lot of confidence. You know, it was one of my goals, and to be able to do it for myself and also, you know, make history for Canada was really special for me. And after that, you know, I had so much confidence. I brought that into the professionals as well. And, you know, I won the 25,000 in Granby and got the quarters of D.C. last year. So I think that was a stepping stone. And, you know, it just made me believe I could be up there with the best. And, you know, I carried that to the pros. And, you know, I made that transition pretty fluidly, I'd say.
It seems to me that the most successful coaching relationship you had has been with Nathalie Tauziat. She lives in France. I think she has a family. She can't be with you all the time. But she was number three in the world and a Wimbledon finalist. What does somebody like that have to bring to your game?
She's very valuable. I started working with her at Wimbledon in 2011. So, you know, it's been part-time for 2 years now. And, you know, she brings something completely different than most of the coaches I've had in the past. First of all, she's female, and she's been on the tour, and she's been where I want to go. So she knows exactly what I'm going through. And, you know, before the Wimbledon final or when she comes on court during on-court coaching, she brings, you know, a different aspect because she knows what I'm going through. And so she tells me, you know, okay, listen, you know, in my past experience, when this has happened, I've done this, I've had success doing this and not this. And, you know, she gives me tips from a real player, and, you know, I find that very valuable. And, you know, she's definitely helped me a lot.
Speaking of the on-court coaching, I was in France and I was watching your semifinal match with Cornet in Strasbourg on TV. And Cornet was, I think she lost the second set after you'd won the first, and she was really losing it. She was going nuts. She was talking to her coach.
I
she was
heard
saying
about
she
that.
Could win. And then there was an on-court coaching with you when Nathalie came out, and you seemed to be all sort of upset. You said you were so tired and everything. I was a bit surprised because you're such a fantastic competitor normally. Did you let your emotions get a little bit the better of you there?
Well, you know what, I feel like, I mean, obviously it was recorded and maybe, you know, I should think a bit more, but, you know, I was just talking to her like I would talk to her normally, you know, and during the match and, you know, during the points and everything, I put on a brave face. But when she was there, you know, I was telling her honestly how I felt. And, you know, the opponent didn't hear it at the time, so it didn't really, I don't think it really had an effect. But, you know, I was just telling her how I felt. And then so she could really understand. And she was like, you know what, this is what you play tennis for. This is a fight. And, you know, she tried to help me through it.
Yeah, I thought that was great advice by her. Let's talk about Wimbledon. It was just the second Grand Slam event of your career, and in, I think in the second match of your Grand Slam events, you got to play on center court when with Anna Ivanovic when Victoria Azarenka had to pull out with a knee injury. Can you describe just exactly what it was like to, I'm sure since you were a kid you wanted to play on center court at Wimbledon?
Yes, well, it was crazy, and actually even at the French Open, I played on center court against Sharapova in the second round, so I think actually that experience helped me when I played Ivanovic on center court at Wimbledon. So I already had, you know, I already had that experience because it's such a big deal. I mean, especially at Wimbledon, you can't get to a bigger stage in tennis than center court at Wimbledon. So I was so happy, I was so excited, and like you said, you know, Azarenka pulled out, so I only found out 20 minutes before the match that I was going on center court. And, you know, I think it was good because it didn't give me time to get nervous. I was just really excited. And, you know, I was like, yes, I can use the challenge system and everything. And obviously be on, you know, this legendary court. And, you know, I just went out there. I think I was a bit nervous at the beginning in the warm-up a little bit. But, you know, I was really focused, really zoned in. And, you know, my experiences from being on center court and at the French Open and also junior Wimbledon, I got to play on court one in the finals. And, you know, it reminded me a bit of that. It was a little bit similar to that. So that helped me as well. So, you know, just more of these experiences on these big courts, I think, is the best thing.
What's the whole procedure like going from the locker room down through the club and out onto the center court? Was that kind of intimidating and was it interesting? Do you take it all in?
Well, especially at Wimbledon, it's more much more formal than any other tournament of the whole year. You know, they're very... they stick to their traditions and their rules. So it's really interesting to see. I mean, well, basically, you know, they told us, like I said, 20 minutes before, you know, I got ready. And then, you know, a lady, she would walk us out, you know, through, like, the royal area inside, through the members area, you know. So you're walking in your tennis shoes and you feel like you should be wearing, you know, a really nice outfit and heels because you're on this, like, carpet and there's gold and trophies everywhere. And it's so impressive. And it just... It made me feel like the moment was so big, and you know, which it was. So, but I love all that stuff about Wimbledon. I had, you know, similar experiences in the juniors last year. I was able to go in the Royal Box last year, and I had to go through the same thing. So, you know, I felt like I belonged a little bit.
You have excellent concentration on the court. You're a very good fighter. I'm sure that's never been a problem for you. Does that just come naturally?
I think you have to have it within yourself to even have a chance, but I think it's something that can be worked on as well. You know, for sure, I try to stay focused and fight, you know, as much as I can every match, but there are some matches where, you know, it doesn't go your way as much and it's just not as good. And, you know, I try to work on it. You know, I try to really, really focus. And when I feel myself losing focus, I got to get myself back into the match, you know, stay really focused on the court. And, you know, it's not perfect. And I really have to work on it every match, but part of it for sure is, you know, something I've always had even from when I was little. So I say it's a bit of both.
You travel all over the world playing tournaments, and there's, I guess, just two chances really to play at home, the Bell Challenge in Quebec City and obviously the Rogers Cup in Toronto.
Yep.
What's it like to play in Canada? What's the best part about playing in Canada?
I love it. I don't have much opportunity to play at home in front of, you know, my home fans. And so whenever I get to play in Canada, I really, you know, try to soak it all in and take advantage of it. Last year in Montreal, I had great, you know, fan support, and I think it helps. And I don't get that extreme support around the world like I do in Canada. So I always love it. And, you know, next week at the Rogers Cup, I want to use it to the best of my ability and just enjoy every moment because being at home is the best, and I want to show, you know, my Canadian fans how I can play.
Just a bit of a goofy question to finish things up here. What's the most surprising thing that we would find in your racket bag?
Oh, my God. well, I don't know if I should admit this, but I have like a Hello Kitty keychain thing, and it's my little good luck charm I keep in my bag, and I guess I'd say that would be it. Besides that, I have pretty professional-looking things, but I have this pink Hello Kitty doll in my bag, and that's a bit out of the ordinary.
Well, we hope the Hello Kitty doll works next week in Toronto. Thank you very much for being on the show.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Jeannie Bouchard, charming young lady, Tom, and boy, what a great future ahead for her.
Yeah, Roger, I went out today and bought a Hello Kitty figurine. I figure it might up sort of my level of tennis. I need every help I can get.
Smart idea. I'd carry it with you everywhere you go because it's working for her, that's for sure. That's Tom Devitt. He's in Montreal. I'm Roger Lajoie here in Toronto. Thanks again to Jeannie Bouchard. Monica Seles is on the way, and your chance to win Roger's Cup tickets. So please do stick around. Your questions for Tom at Roger at sportsnet590.ca on Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca. Tennis, anyone? This is Aces with your hosts Roger Lajoie and Tom Tebbett of Tennis Canada. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Reach the show by email at roger at sportsnet590.ca, roger at sportsnet590.ca. We're taking your questions for Tom Tebbett. I'm Roger Lajoie in Toronto. Tom is in Montreal. We're talking, of course, what else? Tennis, because it's Aces, Canada's only regularly scheduled tennis radio program. This segment of Aces is brought to you by the National Bank. Strong service, agility, great returns are as important in banking as they are on the tennis court. That's why National Bank is proud to sponsor the 2013 Rogers Cup. Visit nbctennis.ca. For details. Coming up later, we will have Tom's mailbag. We will have a chance to win Rogers Cup tickets. But Tom, let's get to this one. Monica Seles, what a name.
Yeah, Roger. I mean, I don't know if you were there in 95 when.
Yes, I was.
Came back 2.5 years. There was never a tournament like it. There were satellite trucks all over the place just outside the tournament grounds. And there was an international press corps like we've never seen before at the tournament. And just the whole world was curious to see what she'd be like after, I guess it was 26 or 27 months away. It was a fascinating time, and how good she was, it was also just mind-boggling. It was incredible. She, you know, just didn't miss a beat. And anyway, that was actually the first question I asked her in the interview.
She overcame a really horrible situation and became a great player once again. Tom Tebbett's conversation with Monica Seles.
Monica Seles, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tom.
In 1975, the Rogers Cup, then the Canadian Open in Toronto, was probably the most highly publicized Canadian Open in the history of the event. That, of course, was your return after 27 months away from tennis after the incident in Hamburg. What do you remember about that tournament?
Well, I mean, that event will always hold a very special place in my heart, and it reassured me how much I miss tennis and how rightful of a decision I made after not playing for 2.5 years and returning. It couldn't have been more of a positive environment, the fans, the tennis tournament. So it just really, for me, put me back on that right track that, yes, I love tennis, I love playing tennis, and it was the right decision to come back in Toronto.
Your scores in that tournament were amazing. It was 6-love, 6-3, 6-2, 6-2, 6-3, 6-2, 6-1, 6-love in the semifinals against Gabriella Sabatini, and 6-love, 6-1 in the final against Amanda Coetzer. Were you surprised at how well you played?
Yeah, I think it took me totally by surprise, and I think everybody around me also, because obviously I didn't play any matches for about 1.5 years. So, you know, you still don't know how you're going to play till you step out there. But I look back at those scores, and all I can think of is just, wow, I played the best week of my life. I was so excited to be back playing. The support I got from the fans, I think, gave me that extra energy. And it's like one of those tournaments now that I'm retired that you realize it was just like a dream. It couldn't have gone better.
From 1991 to 1993, in 8 Grand Slams that you played, you won 7 of those, and the only one you lost was in the Wimbledon final, and there was a big brouhaha about your grunting and everything, so maybe it wasn't the best circumstance for you. But during that period, did you almost feel unbeatable when you went on the court?
I think from like that 90 to 93, I was just playing such good tennis. I mean, and, you know, you have that youth on your side, so you just go out there, your body's able to practice hour after hour. So I look back very fondly at those years and wish I had a few more years like that in my career now that I've retired, but I sure play some great tennis.
The 1992 French Open final was maybe one of the best tennis matches ever. You beat Steffi Graf 6-2, 3-6, and 10-8 in the third set. Just a phenomenal quality of play. Was that the most exciting match you ever played?
I think so. I think that one is probably right up there because we both wanted to win it so badly and we're so even going into the tournament. And to have the number one, number two ranked players fighting it out in the finals of a Grand Slam and have a third set with a score like that, to me it's like a boxing championship prize fight. And those are the matches that we'll remember long after kind of the era is gone, kind of like for me, Graf, Sellers, the era is done. But we still remember matches like that.
I was talking to Fru McMillan, who was a great doubles player back in the 60s and 70s, and he played with two hands on both sides, as you did. He said he feels a bond, almost a camaraderie, with the other two-handed players. Did you feel the same?
Definitely. I mean, even as a youngster, I remember meeting a Gene Mayer, who was kind of like the first two-hander of both sides. And then, obviously, while I was on the tour, I enjoyed watching and even hitting some taps against Fabrice Santoro, the French gentleman, and then watching Marion Bartoli win Wimbledon. It was just really special because it's such an unorthodox way to play tennis. I think or you love it or it's just not for you because you are shorter on one side. For me, that was the forehand, which you do have to move a few extra steps because of it. But at the same point, the angles you're able to create are, you know, the best.
You mentioned three players, Santoro, Gene Mayer, and Bartoli. Which of the two-handed players on both sides do you think you enjoyed watching the most?
Well, I think unfortunately, Gene Mayer was kind of before my time. I only got to watch him in person once. But somebody like Fabrice Santoro, immensely enjoy watching both in singles and doubles, what he's able to do. His hands are just, I call him the magician. And then, of course, Marion Bartoli, who a long time ago I played when she was a young teenager, and it was really a weird sight to see somebody on the other side who's just playing the same way as I was. And then it was great joy to watch her finally win her first Grand Slam title.
Could you teach a young player to play with two hands on both sides, or do you think it's something that just happens naturally on its own?
To me, it happened naturally just because as a child growing up, we didn't have kids' rackets, so the racket was so big I had to hold it two hands on both sides. I think if let's say a coach, my student, would pick up a racket, two hands on both sides, I would kind of feel it out. I would try to hit a few balls one-handed, a few two-handed. I mean, for a while, they try to change my forehand to a one-hander, but for me, it just didn't work.
One of the harder shots to hit in tennis is a high-bouncing, looping ball to your backhand. I once asked you how come you were so good at doing that, handling those high loopers, and you replied, "Oh, my dad and I, we worked on it one day, and after that, everything was okay."
Yes.
Was it really that simple?
Maybe that was a little bit of exaggeration or youth on my side. But in junior tennis, I was always the smallest kid in the tournament, and a lot of girls would just moonball me, and these balls would just go over my head because I was really tiny. So my dad said, just hit it on the rice, kind of like, you know, when Tom is chasing a cherry. So kind of that's that cartoon image that I always had in my head. As soon as the ball bounces, just pounce on it, Monica. Hit it on the rise. So later on, as I entered about my teenagers, actually became my favorite shot, and I loved playing players who had more topspin on it where the ball bounced a bit higher, and I think that's why I had more success on clay and hard courts compared to grass.
Wow, that's an amazing thing that most people, the shot they would like the least is the one you like the most.
Well, I mean, that's why I love players who would hit high balls, because I never felt threatened by them, because I knew if I could just hit it on the rise and I hit, you know, hour after hour balls like that coming from my dad's racket or from a basket. So to me, it was like a second nature.
You played Serena five times in your career. I think the last time was actually in Toronto in 2001. It was 7-5, 7-6 for Serena. I think she was 4-1 in the career with you. But for a one-time match, do you think Serena would be the toughest player to play?
For me, for sure, just because the first time I played Serena, I think she was 16 years old. She was just like her first pro tournament in Chicago, and soon as she actually beat me there, and I called my agent, and I was number one at this time in the world, I said, my days are limited, because I could just see physically she was very much stronger, and she had a huge first serve already at that age, and plus her ground strokes are very solid, so she had the fundamentals, so I knew that if she would just keep practicing, staying on that track, sooner or later she'll be, you know, the future number one.
In my years in tennis, Chris Evert, Tracy Austin, Maria Sharapova, Serena Williams, and you are the best competitors I've ever seen. Maybe Maureen Conley back in her day, Susan Longland, Helen Wills way back when. But can you explain your competitive drive and how you were so exceptional? Where did that concentration come from?
For me, I think as a little kid, I always was very focused with that being my studies or, you know, tennis. And I think I was very lucky that I found a passion that I could kind of share with my parents. So I enjoy tagging along. If my dad played, I just enjoy watching. And then just wanting to be able to play with my dad by myself, where I lived in my former country of Yugoslavia, I would just hit on the wall in the apartment building all alone, just an old ragged little ball and things like that. So I enjoyed the solitude of tennis. And actually, when I first made any money in tennis, my big thing was that I wanted to buy was a tennis wall, because I just wanted, again, that solitude of just hitting against the ball. And to this day, that's my favorite way to play tennis.
Your last match was more than 10 years ago. I think you were 29 at the 2003 French Open. You had a foot injury at the time, I think, and a foot problem. Why were you not able to get that better? Was there something really, obviously something quite serious about it?
Well, it was my sesamoid bone that just broke into pieces, and I had an option of just trying to rest it, waiting for it to heal. The other one was to take it totally out or put a screw in. And really, all the options were 50%, so I just decided, let me rest it and see. And I tried for a couple of years. That's why I didn't want to retire. I really wanted to make sure once I retire, I'm retired. I don't want to retire unretired. I never liked that when athletes would do it. So for me, I tried for about 4 or 5 years there, and then I think when reality set in, my age got up there in the, you know, low 30s, and my body was just, I think it's time, you know, to call it a day.
I think I recall you running around the French Open before a match and giving flowers to the crowd. Do you remember that Monica Seles?
I vaguely remember it. I was actually Nick Baltieri is doing his book, and it was one of the things that when I was talking to Nick, we reminded each other in our lovely youth and some other stuff. So sometimes I do go back in memory lane, kind of like earlier Tom I was mentioning to with the pictures, you know, categorizing them 89, 1990, because a tennis player, you travel week in, week out. So a lot of events besides, like, let's say the big ones and things like that are a blur, because as soon as you finish, you're mentally and physically on the next plane, and you're right away focusing on the next tournament. So it's kind of like, okay, let's get this done, jump on a plane next week, same. So it's kind of nice in my retirement when I look back at some photos. Some of them I do have vivid memories, and some of them actually have to talk to a few other people who are there to kind of remind me, oh, really, I did that, or really, I did wear that hairstyle, or stuff like that.
What are you up to these days, Monica?
Well, one of my new passions that I kind of came out of, you know, just a fun doodle project as I was doing tournaments, I got into writing, fiction writing. So I had my first young adult book published about a month ago, and the series is called The Academy, and the first book is called Game On, and it follows four teenagers' lives in a fictional academy. One is a tennis player, a golfer, a swimmer, and a football player. And I have a second book coming out next year. So that would kind of been really my fun project that's still part of tennis, but outside of tennis. And obviously, I love still playing tennis as much as I can. It's unfortunately most limited to doubles. But events like being invited back to Toronto for the Rogers Cup, I'm so excited. I love playing there and to play against Martina and with my partner, Eugene Bouchard, I think will be just very exciting.
So I think Serena's involved in that too, is she not?
It's supposed to be, I think, Serena and Venus and Eugene.
Right. So how do you get ready to play Serena?
A lot of practice. And I'm hoping my partner has a lot quicker legs. She is a lot younger than I am. And just, you know, going out there and hitting the ball hard and really trying to make Serena move, as you know, and hoping she has a little bit of an off day. But most importantly, just going out there trying to control the ball. That's kind of been always my signature.
Well, Monica, it's been a real treat to have you on the show tonight. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Monica Seles. And Tom, you know, she had really two careers when you think of it, after the terrible incident in Germany, her comeback as a player. And boy, I'll tell you, she's reinvented herself. Really, legend gets thrown around a little too much, but I'd put her in that category, boy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real shame. She only won 9 Grand Slams. I think she had 8 before she was stabbed. And who knows what would have happened if that hadn't happened. I mean, she could easily have been up around 20. It's really a shame, but she always did well in Canada. I think she won our tournament in 92 and then 95, 96, 97, 4 times. So it'll be fun to see her back here next Monday night.
Will be, for sure. That's part of the fun of the Rogers Cup. We'll talk more about the Rogers Cup here on Aces in a moment. Tom Tebbit is in Montreal. Roger Lajoie here in our studio. Your questions for Tom are welcome. Got to be quick, though. Roger at Sportsnet 590.ca. Roger at Sportsnet 590.ca. Be quick. You'll get your question in. We'll read it to Tom in the next update, and you'll have a chance to win Rogers Cup tickets for Tuesday night as well with our mystery sounder still to come. It's Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Prizes like no other, from a club like no other, The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Reviewing every game like Hawkeye Tennis Technology.
This is Daniel Nestor, and you're listening to Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
And this segment of Aces is brought to you by Tennis Canada and the Rogers Cup. Serena and the very best of women's tennis returns to Toronto August 3rd to 11th. Hey, get your tickets now. They're going quick at RogersCup.com. That's RogersCup.com. I'm Roger Lajoie here in Toronto. Tom Tebbett is in Montreal. Those, of course, are the locations of our great Rogers Cups this year. The men are in Montreal. The women are here in Toronto. And we are giving listeners of Aces a chance to win tickets to the Rogers Cup here in Toronto. So keep listening in. And when we play the mystery sounder, we're going to play it in about 9-10 minutes time. Hear the sounder, identify who it is, send us an email, roger@sportsnet590.ca, roger@sportsnet590.ca, and you will be entered in a draw to win the tickets. We'll select among all the winners. And another week or two, Tom and I will announce the winner of the new Wilson tennis racket as well. And your support of our show has been great, folks. We really appreciate it. And we've had lots of questions. And that's what we're going to do now is have time for Tom's mailbag. Tom, I hope you got your thinking cap on.
Roger, I never take it off.
Oh, really? That's why you're Mr. Tennyson so smart. Here we go. Charlotte, regular listener to the show, leads us off. She was in early. Charlotte, thank you so much for listening as always. And she says, I am curious. And you know, this is a great question, Tom. I'm curious what criteria do tournaments, and the majors in particular, consider when handing out wild cards? Is there a mathematical formula to wild cards, or is it just a case of, like, how do they do it?
Well, I mean, it's a totally discretionary thing. Whatever you want to do, you can do. Most tournaments do players from the host country. But it was interesting in Wimbledon this year because, excuse me, I think they have 8 wild cards. And they decided they only had, I think, 4 or 5 guys who really deserved to get it. And actually, Vasek Pospisil got in because he was 2 or 3 out. And because they didn't distribute all the wild cards to the players from their host country, they were actually available for other people. And they said, we're just going to go off the rankings. So in countries like Canada, normally you give it to the Canadian players who aren't directly in, like Eugenie Bouchard has one this year, Frank Zancevic has one, Jesse Levine, people who play Fed Cup and Davis Cup for the country. That's part of the deal. If you represent your country, then you'll be eligible for the wild cards.
Well, interesting, and there is no formula to that. Charlotte, thanks so much for that question. It's something I've wondered about, too, in terms of the semantics of it. But the local players is the best way to do it. Lyle emails in and says, hey, Rog and Tom, I'm 25 years old, and only know recent Hall of Fame inductee Cliff Drysdale as a great tennis commentator. Can Tom educate some of the younger listeners like myself on his career in tennis beyond the microphone? Lyle, thank you. Tell us about him, Tom.
Well, he was a very good player. I would say they didn't have the ATP rankings until before 1973, so he would have been. But he would have been a top 10 player. He made the final of the U.S. Open once, and what I remember actually, excuse me, seeing him late in his career, it was very interesting. He actually played with a glove on his hand. I think it was on his two-handed backhand, which was pretty eccentric. But he was a very solid player.
Very solid player and a pretty good announcer as well. We're taking questions for Tom Tebbett. And yes, we are going to have the Rogers Cup draw shortly. So stick around for that, folks. Tom emails in. 2-part question here for you, Tom. And he'd like the response to the first question before I give you the second. So the first question, are there any non-active singles players, male or female, who've won multiple majors but did not make it to the Tennis Hall of Fame that you're aware of? Tom, do you have anyone come to mind that's not in the Hall of Fame that's won a non-active players that have won a couple of majors?
Yeah, Evgeny Kafelnikov has won 2, and he hasn't made it. I probably should be able to think of some others as well, but Michael Chang is even having only won 1. So it's quite discretionary. There's sort of tennis writers and various tennis people who vote on this, and you know, just like the Baseball Hall of Fame, a lot of people have their opinions, and maybe some people don't like Kafelnikov that much, or maybe they don't think he did, you know, deserve to get there. But he actually was 1 as well, and Michael Chang was never 1. So I think it's going to be pretty hard to keep him out.
Interesting. And the second part of the question then is, do you think Kuznetsova will make the Hall of Fame?
Gee, in a lot of ways, she's very similar to Kafelnikov, and they're both Russian, so that's sort of funny. I would think probably, just because she's won 2 Grand Slams. She won the U.S. Open, she won the French Open, and she also was a very good doubles player as well. And I think a lot of people Yeah, Kafelnikov could be an ornery guy. I think everybody, a lot of people like Kuznetsova. She was a pretty nice woman and is still a very nice woman and still a very good player. So I would think eventually she makes it, yes.
You know, it's interesting, Tom, when you see that Hall of Fame, regardless, personality of the person really does enter into it. Nobody can argue that when you really do study Hall of Fame. So interesting question. Thanks for that. Stacy emails in and says, guys, I've always thought that Roger Federer would be similar to Tim Duncan, Tom Brady, Steve Nash in the sense that the way he plays the game will allow him to age gracefully and the inevitable decline would be gradual as opposed to sudden. Stacy adds, however, Federer's performance has taken a steep decline in recent weeks. If you had to quantify it, how much of his recent poor play should be attributed to him adjusting to a new racket and how much of it is the back issues and how much of it is just the natural effects of father's time? Stacy, thank you for the email, Tom. We've talked about Federer. We never want to write him off, but he has had a tough go recently. How much of a factor is it? Is it just maybe his time is starting to come?
Well, there's no question. I think the last couple of years, obviously, we've seen Djokovic and Murray and Nadal, you know, more or less taking over from him a little bit. His last hurrah, really, was Wimbledon last year when he won that, beating Andy Murray. I think recently the back has been responsible for a lot of stuff. Certainly the two tournaments on clay in Europe, in Hamburg and in Gstaad, definitely he was diminished. And he definitely had a problem. I saw him play the match in Indian Wells against Nadal in March, and he had problems there. He said it didn't bother him at Wimbledon when he, you know, when he lost to Stachowski, and the same thing at the French when he lost to Sanga. I don't know. It's hard to figure out. I think the back is a huge thing, but there's definitely a drop-off. I mean, who can we actually put a percentage on it? None of us want to believe that the probably the greatest player of all time you know, is becoming a little more human and a little more beatable, but I think it's happening. But it's a fascinating thing is, you know, Sampras had that last gasp when he won the U.S. Open. I think Federer's fans hope maybe there's one of those, but possibly the last gasp actually was last year at Wimbledon.
It could very well be. I just hope he goes out, you know, before it gets too embarrassing and there's too many of those first-round upsets in any athlete, any sport. I don't like to see it end like that. We'll see. Listen, maybe he gets turned around in Montreal. Give him some time.
Well, I think if the back's okay, then it's a whole new ball game. So
yeah.
Hopefully he can be healthy, and then we can see exactly just the natural decline, not affected by a physical thing.
Hear, hear to that. Volker emails in. My question for Tom is below Roger. Do you have any theories or explanations, Tom, for the disparity between Sloane Stephens' results at the majors as opposed to regular tour events? Thank you, Volker. A lot of players don't do nearly as well in majors as regular tour events. Why in that case?
Well, it's hard to figure out. I think she's only 20 years old, and she's a very good player. She's the best young player in the States by far, although Madison Keys is a very good player, too. I don't know. I really don't know. You have to give her credit. If you can play best at the biggest events, then it's a good sign for the future. But it shows a little bit of a vulnerability when you can't sort of have your concentration every time out. I mean, somebody like Eugenie Bouchard, I think you're never going to get her, you know, not really pumped up for an event. And so there's some little weakness there with Sloane Stephens, but she's a fantastic player, a fantastic athlete, and, you know, you should expect big things of her.
Thanks very much for that email. Ed emails in. Speaking of Jeannie Bouchard, guys, enjoying the show very much. Tom, really enjoyed your interview with Jeannie Bouchard on the program, and I'm curious as to you think how far she can go. I know it's always difficult to try to put a firm figure on it, but boy, when you look at her progression and what she did in the Wimbledon Juniors, seems to be the sky's the limit, and maybe she'll benefit, with a question mark after the maybe, she'll benefit with the fact that all the heat is on Milos Raonic to represent Canadian tennis, a little different than back in the day with Caroline Bassett. Thanks for that, Ed. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Is it any easier for Bouchard that Raonic is, you know, the player that he is, too?
Yeah, I think maybe it takes a little bit of attention away from her, and maybe she can sort of toil in anonymity a little bit more. But, I mean, she's done awfully well, 144 to 58 now. She's been as high as 53. She performed extremely well at Wimbledon, beating Ivanovic on center court. She seems to like the big occasion. It's always hard to put a number on. Caroline Bassett was number 8. I think Alexandra Wozniak got as high as 21. I think, you know, I don't think many people would doubt that she's definitely got a good chance to get inside the top 20, and from there, you know, who knows. But the good thing is that the mental part of her game is so strong, and I think that's, you got to have the shots and stuff, but the mental part is really important. I think she's definitely got that.
Thanks, Ed, for that email. Jermaine emails in and says, I'm interested in Tom's thoughts on who the best play-by-play and color analysts are in tennis. I personally like Chris Fowler, Mike Tricchio's play-by-play guys. I like Killer Cahill and Brad Gilbert as color analyst. Jermaine, thank you. Tom, you have any favorites? Or, yeah, they're all pretty good.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I've always had the problems with this. Bud Collins is a guy I know, and they either loved or hate him. And I think it's a lot the same with a lot of announcers and commentators in various sports. But I think all the names you mentioned there were great. I guess I always liked Cliff Drysdale and Patrick McEnroe just because they were sort of like an old soft shoe team together. They just it was like you were just sitting, you know, in your couch at home watching the match and, you know, shooting the bull with them. And I always liked that aspect of them. So there's a lot of good people. John McEnroe is actually quite good, although, you know, but he can be maybe a difficult guy off the court. But he's a very intelligent guy, so he's good as a commentator. And, you know, there's a bunch of them. There's a couple I don't really like at all, but we won't mention them, will we, Roger?
No, we don't want to start any arguments now. You be nice, Tom, okay? Helen emails in, regular listener to the show. And Helen, thank you. In light of the fact that we talked to Monica Seles tonight, or you did, Tom, this is a very interesting question. Helen wants to know what's up with the security at some tennis events. We've had major breaches of security during the French Open final on two occasions in the last 4 years, the hat incident with Federer in 2009 and the flare incident this year. There was also an incident at the U.S. Open a few years ago when a fan ran on the court and tried to kiss Rafael Nadal after a match. And Helen, thank you very much. I know it's very, very hard, and you don't want to, you know, put any attention on somebody, Tom, who, you know, by calling more attention to when these things happening. But given that tragedy there, yeah, is there reason for concern?
No, they definitely stepped it up since then. So it's always a concern. Actually, there's a final in Stanford on Sunday. Sibulkova won, and her father ran out in the court. And, you know, that could have been anybody.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, the incident you talk about the French, I think on the whole, I mean, you just can't have it hyper-security. I mean, I suppose, you know, at a Blue Jays game or whatever, you could jump on the field and do something. So I think they do a pretty good job. They're very aware of the dangers, and I think they sort of track whatever possibilities it could be threatening, and, you know, players in various countries and stuff like that. But on the other hand, you don't want to be obsessed with it because it would really make everything so rigid and a lot less enjoyable.
For sure. Let's get one more quick one in, and then we will go to our sounder. Mac has more of an exercise. It's an interesting question. Wants to talk about building the perfect male and female player if he had certain things. And he's talked to us about this before, Tom. So this is something for you to think about maybe next time. You know, what makes a great player's forehand, backhand, serve, return of serve, and you had the top male players and everything else. If you had the perfect player, and let me ask you this, and we'll talk about this next week when we're at the Rogers Cup in Toronto. If you did have to, you know, say, what is the top part of a Federer's game or a McEnroe's game?
Well, I mean, it's two simple things. You got to have the physical talent, you got to have the mental side. And McEnroe, I think, had a lot more of the physical talent. I mean, he was just a genius. Federer is a genius too, but he had the mental side as well. And McEnroe had the mental side as well, but he used to have to go crazy and drive everybody nuts before he got there, sort of thing. So I think it's really hard it's a hard, you know, special thing. I mean, you look at Nadal. I mean, he's just a tremendous fighter and a tremendous athlete, maybe not as good a tennis player in a sense, stroke for stroke, as Federer. So there's just so many things that go into it. It's hard. But, you know, I think you never underestimate the mental side. Chris Evert once said, I remember, that tennis was 80% mental. And I think maybe that's an exaggeration, but I think it just emphasizes how important that is.
Sure does. That's Tom Tebbit. All right, time now for the mystery sounder, Tom. Rogers Cup tickets up for grabs. Listen in, folks. Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. If you can identify this mystery sounder, email, and you could win the Rogers Cup tickets and qualify to win the Wilson Tennis Racket. Let's have a listen.
Roger, I love this one.
Okay.
I think this is a revolution in Canadian tennis. I mean, this tie over here, you know, with the two wins we got today. And we just got to, you know, we got to go strong. These guys aren't finished yet. You know, they're going to come strong tomorrow. They got a great doubles team. And it's not over till it's over.
I like the quote, that's for sure.
Not over till it's over, Roger.
Yeah.
I'll believe that one.
But it's not Yogi Berra, though. Everyone, do not guess Yogi Berra. It is not Yogi Berra. It is a tennis personality. Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. If you know the answer, Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. Email us and we will select a winner for the Tuesday night here in Toronto. Quickly, Tom, Rogers Cup coming up both in Montreal and Toronto. We got some of the top players here and it's a special time. Fans got to get out and support these great events.
Yes, you do. Just let me say something quick. That was a Canadian player. And the winner of the quiz will get the Wilson Steam Racket, and will get into the draw for the Wilson Steam Racket, and then obviously be in the we'll have two tickets for next Tuesday night at the Rogers Cup, August 6th, at the Rexall Center. Yeah, no, it's a great time. I mean, we just hope for good weather. The fields are looking good. Everybody's pumped up. These are really the two biggest tournaments so far going to the U.S. Open. I think the players are, you know, the next week in Cincinnati is important as well, but I think this is the first one really for a lot of players like Djokovic and Murray and Nadal since Wimbledon. So they're really pumped, and it's really fun to see them in this state because they're eager again. And so, you know, same thing with the women in Toronto. It's, you know, Serena did play a small tournament afterwards, but she's going to be playing her first real tournament on hard courts. And so it's great. And like I said, just keep our fingers crossed for the weather. It should be terrific tennis.
We look forward to it indeed. Joey Montreal, Tom, and we will see you next Wednesday. And we'll be doing the show right from the Rogers Cup here in Toronto. Stay well. Enjoy the tennis, buddy.
Okay, thanks, Roger.
That's Tom Tebbit. I'm Roger Lajoie. Thanks to Derek Brandeo, our technical director, Gord Brunt, our producer, Jeannie Bouchard, and Monica Sellis for joining us. You know the sounder. Email the show, roger at sportsnet590.ca, roger at sportsnet590.ca. Tom and I will be back with another edition of Tennis live from the Rogers Cup next Wednesday, and all the details will be available at sportsnet590.ca. Coming up next, Jeff Sammet on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.